Good morning. First case this morning is United States v. English. Is the appellant prepared to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Heather Marie Martin, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Todd Simpson, we represent the appellant, Specialist Luke English. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Because the Army Court is limited to affirming the offense to that theory for which the government specifically charged in Specification 6. Not only did the government argue that specific theory at trial, but they also had specifically referred it to that same trial. As a result, the Army Court cannot affirm the remainder of the specification because it thought there was other unlawful force, because that is a different theory than what was presented at trial and not in the charged language. The Supreme
Major Martin, I hate to jump in early, but I might forget my question later on.
So. Yes,
this, you say this is a different theory, but the government is arguing that this is simply a variance. In other words, it's kind of like exceptions without substitutions in this case. What's your response to that? Because they're saying that the theory hasn't changed, it's just that the manner of how the unlawful force is applied has changed.
Yes, Your Honor. I have two responses to that question. Right. First is that there is no variance on appeal. The Army Court's power has limits in this case to either affirming the sentence or affirming a lesser included offense. And they opted not to do the latter, but instead to strike the language.
So you're saying the CCA doesn't have the authority in its factual sufficiency mode to make exceptions? Is that your point?
I would say that there are some situations where they can. For example, we know that they can with regards to diverse occasions, but here we have a specific, a very different situation. It's almost the inverse of Ober. In Ober, the government charged generally, but then at the trial argued very specific two different theories of liability. Here we have a narrow theory of liability in the specification, and so we can't go broader once we're already narrow. And so it's almost the inverse. And I think that principle is pretty similar to what we've seen in Reese, although Reese is about major and minor changes. The end result is very similar. In that case, the trial court accepted the language about what is a lewd act, that specific to wit language, and then substituted with something else, a different theory, a different modality. And they couldn't do that here. And because the principles of major and minor changes and variances are very similar, we're just looking at it from what the appellate courts can do. And I would say for the reasons in Ober and the reasons in Reese, that we are very limited to what the government had charged. And so anything else is a parallel or different offense or a different theory. Those are all synonyms for the same issue.
Well, it's not an element of the offense, right?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, yes.
Grabbing her by the head is not an element of the offense. Force is an element of the offense.
Your Honor, here we have a factual predicate that is merged with the element of the offense. And that's what
makes it different. What does that mean?
Well, otherwise,
it's merged with the element. Is it an element or is it not?
It's part of the element. Because they
you mean because the government chose to impose this on itself?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now they're stuck with it.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, now they're stuck with it, not because it's an element. Well, because it's an element. I still don't quite get your theory.
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize for that. Specifically, unlawful force, comma, to wit, they decided to limit that the scope of how appellant could be found guilty. And in this specific case, it's not that, I understand that the unlawful force is an element, but the factual predicate, they added that.
Do you have any case law that supports that proposition?
Your Honor, the appellant has presented case law on surplusage, because I believe that if you don't think that it's an element,
case law what?
On surplusage. And so I think it's pretty clear that if you don't think it's an element of the offense, then you have to analyze it as to whether it's surplusage. But it's not. And the federal cases that we cited in our reply brief would support that. For example, let's say the appellant decided to, at trial, say that they wanted to motion to strike because of surplusage. They would have lost because the trial judge would have said this is part of the element of unlawful force. And so I'm just In the alternative, it's similar. When we
well, would they back. Have lost? They said, we want to strike grabbing her by the head. We're not striking the element. We're not striking force. We're the government. We have to prove force beyond a reasonable doubt. So would the judge have denied that?
Two responses to your question, Your Honor. First is, I think that there's a difference between asking whether or not it's an essential element of the offense. Is that part of the element? And in this case, yes, it is. But secondly, I think Reese has that still kind of an open question as to whether or not you can just strike language and make it broader than when the government has specifically narrowed it.
Well, yeah, that's two different questions. Yeah, you know, the question of what is it?
Yes, sir.
Is it an element? And it certainly, I don't think it's an element. But the question of whether the government can do it is a different question.
Your Honor, and I think what's important is that the government could have charged this broadly and just left it at unlawful force.
Well, that's your point. You're saying they imposed this burden on themselves.
Exactly.
And now they're stuck with it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
And then because the accused was convicted of that, now the Army Court is limited to...
Well, he was convicted of what?
Unlawful force, to wit, grabbing her head with his
He was convicted of unlawful force because unlawful force is an element of the offense. I'm less sure he was convicted of grabbing her by the head, but...
Well, he was convicted of grabbing her head with his hands. It was part of the to wit language. And so what happened was then the CCA came in and said that was factually insufficient. But they said there was other unlawful force. That other unlawful force, other means a different theory. It's not the same theory for which he was convicted. And I think that's supported by Dunn, Chiarella, and Bennett, because we know that from those cases, especially in cases such as Bennett, that the actual language in the specification makes a difference. And because the government chose to charge that specific modality, limit itself to it, and intended to prove it at trial, and we know that because not only did they talk about it during the cross-examination of the direct examination of DE, but also in the argument itself, where they were specifically arguing to the fact finder, the military judge, that this is what had actually occurred when it wasn't supported by the record.
If you had made a motion for a finding of not guilty to the military judge at trial, what could the military judge have done?
For a motion of not guilty, Your Honor, mm-hmm. He could have granted that motion because it was not supported by the evidence at trial.
Could he have found him guilty by exceptions?
Your Honor, our position is no. However, I know that could possibly remain an open question under Reese, because under Reese we had to specifically substitute different language, so we haven't necessarily seen that particular fact pattern. But I think there are arguments on both sides, and our position is that he wouldn't because the government specifically limited themselves.
Counsel, can we go back to something I just to make sure I understood your position. If the charge sheet in the specification had not contained the to-wit language regarding the method of unlawful force, and so the specification was exactly the same, it just didn't include from the very beginning that to-wit language, and the proof at trial was the same as it was, could the Court of Criminal Appeals have upheld the case, the decision?
Possibly, Your Honor, and I say that only because of Ober. That would be much more similar to the Ober case that this court heard. And the difference being is that we would be talking more about what was specifically argued at trial, the theories of liability the government provided notice of. And I think that's different here because whereas in Ober they narrowed it at the scope of how they were presenting their evidence, we had it narrowed even before that, before referral of charges when it was preferred this narrowly.
Well, what would the consequence then be of the position that you're taking? Is the government ever going to put to-wit language in the future? I mean, if we conclude that we have to reverse in this case, and you're saying, but if they hadn't put the language in, they probably would have won or could have won, won't this have very far-reaching consequences for the military justice system? I mean, I'm just thinking, when would the government want to put to-wit language in the specification?
Your Honor, I have two responses for that. First, it seems as though from both the federal case law and from the military case law that the government can charge broadly But there are other mechanisms in place at the trial level that allows defense counsel in a notice pleading jurisdiction to do things like request a bill of particulars. And even so, the bill of particulars will still limit the government. I believe that is our position, that it would act the same way as charging that specific language because they're putting the defense on notice. So the government operates at a risk to know the facts for which they're going to present at trial, to know what witnesses are going to say, and to charge appropriately. And if they don't, and it's too broad, then we have a bill of particulars and other mechanisms or motions for the defense counsel to make all the way through findings to get relief for those errors.
You have a question? Counsel, you've got a photo of her tied up with duct tape, which certainly seems to imply force. Is the point that tying her up with duct tape isn't the right kind of force? I guess I'm going back to what you're saying, said earlier. It's maybe force, but it's not the right kind of force. The right kind of force, if the government's going to win, is grabbing her by the head.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
The government specifically charged this language and limited itself. In fact, according to the government's briefing, it was Appellant's interpretation of it that you could imply different types of theories of what force means. And it's this kind of hypothetical that we would be engaging in, which is why the notice, this is all ingrained in notice ultimately at this stage of the appeal, because...
You lost me about 20 words back. Say that again.
Your Honor, frankly, when I read the government's reply to my brief, it seemed like we were still speculating as to exactly what force was used,
okay.
Whether it's fear or something else. And so it's very different. It's very speculative. But at the end of the day, we know what the government intended to prove. We know what they referred to the trial. And that's just ultimately what they didn't prove on appeal under an Article 66 review. And that was my point, was we would just be speculating. Instead, we know, and we also know, what the CCA can do about that. They can either affirm or affirm on a lesser included offense. They opted to not do the latter, but instead to strike the language which was not within their powers under Article 59A or supported by Dunn or Bennett or Ober.
So in terms of getting down to the fundamentals here, it's your position that when it comes to the theory, we've got the Supreme Court McCormick saying appellate court cannot use a different theory. You're saying that a factual predicate, the factual basis for the criminal conduct is incorporated into the theory.
Yes, Your Honor.
And is that always the case? What if the government were to go on at some length in the course of the specification and all of those facts were not proved, but some of those facts, key facts, were proved in the course of the court-martial? How would a CCA or this court tease that out in the future?
Yes, Your Honor. Two responses. First is that is going to be a case-specific and charge-specific analysis. But most importantly, we can look to the federal law and case law from other circuits and our own in terms of how to specifically parse that out. We know that sometimes the government can give too much notice, for example, in a bill of particulars, or maybe put too much in an indictment, for example. There are several cases about that. So I think it's a fact-specific inquiry. What is the material element? And then also, what is it that's tied to that? What was the government trying to prove? Is it a difference between adding a nickname of a co-conspirator, or is it a part of what they were actually intending to prove as to what happened or how they are going to demonstrate the crime occurred? And that's what makes this case different, and that's what makes it similar to Ober, but more of a hybrid with Ober and Reese, and why this court should grant decide in favor of specialist English.
Major Martin.
Oh, go ahead.
Major Martin, you can answer my question on rebuttal when you come back, but the victim's testimony in this case, although she didn't say the accused used his hands to grab her head, she did, I think, say that he shoved his organ into her mouth. So why is that not enough to satisfy and give notice and help properly defend against the what's left now of an unlawful force kind of offense?
Yes, Your Honor. I can address that on rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
Counsel, I just had a brief question, which was, what if the specification said he had grabbed her with his left hand and shoved her head, but the proof of trial was that he used his right hand? In other words, it was a difference, but it was a minor difference. Would your position be the same?
Your Honor, I think it would depend, although I think that it would still say hand. It would still say, it would still have this general force that was used that was similar. Here we don't know what shoving
means. So the CCA just strikes out left, and we have everything the same. So, because they didn't prove it was the left hand, it might have been the right hand. I'll let you think about that on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Any further questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Sandra Ahinga, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Williams, I represent the government. The government asks this court to affirm the findings and sentence because the specification currently before this court for review is correct in law and fact, and the exercise of the Army Court's Article 66 Charlie Powers was appropriate in this case. The government's theory of criminality was always rape by unlawful force and remains rape by unlawful force.
Okay. Now, would you answer the appellant's contention that the government elected to impose this burden on itself of showing by beyond a reasonable doubt that he grabbed her by the head, and having elected to do so, you're stuck with it?
Yes, sir. I believe so. Cases like Morton that talk about indicta, that the government is held to what it charged, must be read in light of our authorities to change specifications as well. So removing, grabbing her head with his hand certainly was a change, but that is sort of where questions about variance come in. And here, where there is a change, it must be both material and substantially prejudicial to the appellant in order to require relief. And here, that is not the case. What the government charges a rape by unlawful force, what he remains guilty of is rape by unlawful force.
Rape by unlawful force, that's kind of multiplicious, isn't it? I mean, by definition, if it's a rape, it's by unlawful force.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
What's happening here is distinguishable from the problem in Riley, because what the government is doing is moving not between theories of liability and 120 alpha 1 through 5, but underlying facts for force in 120 Gulf 5 alpha through Charlie. So different, not moving from unlawful force, for example, to force likely to cause death or grievous bodily harm, or something like rendering unconscious, which would be a Riley problem, but moving from perhaps force sufficient to overcome to perhaps using a weapon, where that is allowed by, say, for example, general findings, but is distinguishable from the problem in United States versus Riley, where they're moving between.
Well, how far apart do you have to get? You have unlawful force by grabbing her by the head, and you have unlawful force by wrapping her with duct tape. Where's that get you? You've got a picture that shows her all wrapped up with duct tape, I think one could imply unlawful force unless she was into duct tape. I'm still back where the appellant left me, which is, you know, the government didn't have to do this, but they did it, and now they're stuck with it. And how does the government get out? First of all, how big are the powers of the CCAs under 66 under factual sufficiency? Because it's a factual sufficiency finding. And does the government need to get out from under this, or what?
Your Honor, I disagree that there is a huge distance between what he is currently held.
Well, in the sense they're both force, there's no difference.
Right,
but that's not the appellant's contention. The appellant's contention is that the government may not have had to impose this on itself, but it elected to, and now it's stuck with it.
Yes, Your Honor. So they're stuck to it to the extent that we read those in light of our powers to be able to change specifications. So RCM 603, major minor changes, findings by acceptance and substitutions, perhaps pre-referral, also Article 34 in making those changes. So it's not ultimately a hard and fast rule. But here what the government did charge was that unlawful force. And because we define unlawful force as a totality of the circumstances, this change here does not change the evidence that would have been presented in the government.
What do you say to the appellant's, I think, argument that the CCA doesn't have the power to create a variance? The variance analysis that we would use if it had been done at trial doesn't apply at the CCA level. What do you say to that argument?
I disagree, Your Honor. We do have United States versus Lubasky, which does talk about the reviewing court's power to find by acceptance and substitutions. We read Lubasky to say that the second tier, this court's power, is limited because of the language in 67. Article 66, Charlie, allows the CCA to approve what is correct in law, in fact, and should be affirmed. And one of the mechanisms by which they exercise that power is by findings by exceptions and substitutions. But conceitedly, substitutions are more problematic than exceptions. And what we don't have here is a substitution. What we do have is that essential element that remains, the unlawful force. And if the problem is variance, the appellant was on notice of unlawful force generally, as well as specifically grabbing her head with his hands. Now here, the government did prove beyond a reasonable doubt the unlawful force.
But don't you think, and I don't mean to belabor this point, but at trial, right, the defense counsel asked the victim, you know, did he grab you, gave her the opportunity to say, did he grab you by the head? And she said she didn't remember, right? And then he argued in closing, I'm not guilty of this offense, right? And the military judge obviously disagreed, right? But isn't that some evidence that they thought that they were defending against the charge of being raped by grabbing by the head?
Yes, Your Honor.
That was the type of force that they thought that they needed to defend against.
Yes, but even if there was some evidence, so under 917, taking the evidence in light most favorable to the government, all reasonable presumptions in their favor as well, and not judging credibility, if there had been evidence of some touching of the head, the government would have still had to use all of the evidence of unlawful force, the totality of the circumstances, in order to prove that that touching was sufficient to overcome the victim's will. So the change here would not have required that the fact finder or the CCA or this court consider any other evidence than what was already presented by the fact finder. So the nature of the charge sheet also places the accused on notice of unlawful force and all of the things that would have encompassed that finding beyond a reasonable
doubt. Well, it appears that there was, whether he grabbed her by the head, he tried to shove his penis in her mouth, which is certainly contact with the head. So where are we? Is that enough?
Perhaps, Your Honor. What I would point out is we do know, even in that moment, she remained tied with duct tape as well during the oral penetration.
So, counsel, let's say that for the sake of argument right now, same facts. In terms of specification, it does not use the to-wit language. It's not there. Defense counsel then says prior to trial counsel, I want a bill of particulars. Trial counsel says, specifically in the request from the defense counsel, they're seeking information about what was this unlawful force. And trial counsel says, hey, what happened is the perpetrator held the victim by the head and forced his penis in her mouth. Are you saying then that the government would not have to prove that based on the bill of particulars?
Your Honor, yes. The government.
So are you saying then that when the government makes representations to defense counsel, official representations through court action, that the government is not bound by the representations that it's making to defense counsel, that defense counsel can be mapping out its trial strategy based on those formal representations, and then in the course of the trial, the government can say, nope, we're going in a different direction here. That's your position?
No, Your Honor. I think what if we are going to make that change, so if the bill of particulars had said grabbing the head with his hands was the only theory, we might be having the same conversation about variance ultimately. But because we define unlawful force in the way that we do, in terms of the totality of the circumstances, even if we had given...
Where are you finding this totality of the circumstances language in the precedential cases here?
I look to United States versus Henderson, Your Honor, and we look to all the things. So not only do we have to prove, say, for example, grabbing the head...
But did Henderson use totality of the circumstances?
In a sense, Your Honor, but we...
But it did not use that phrasing.
No, it did not use the phrasing, no, Your Honor. But what we do look at is the things that happen between the appellant and his victim in order to determine what ultimately the theory of force, whether that was sufficient to overcome her will at the time.
And I don't think anyone disagrees that if the language to wit, by putting your hands on that this wouldn't be necessarily a problem, right? Because you could say, the CCA could say, well, it just said by force, and they had this theory, but there's also this other evidence, and so that's fine. But the question that you really haven't addressed is, what do we do about the language that the government chose to specifically put in the specification?
So, Your Honor, perhaps it's helpful to look in the context.
Because if the language wasn't there, I don't think we'd be here, right? But the government chose to narrow the type of force to a specific type of force.
Yes, Your Honor. So for example, if we look in the context of the motion for 917, say, for example, it was pled with specificity, I think ultimately the remedy under 917 echo at trial would have been the same thing that the CCA offered to the appellant, in that they would have accepted out, the military judge would have accepted out the language, grabbing her head with his hands. Now, perhaps the follow-on is a conversation about variance, about notice, and all those things. But again, we're having that conversation here and can have that conversation because we have to look to the entire record, to DE's testimony about the force used to accomplish the sexual act, to determine whether or not there was a lawful force for specification 6. So all of those things put together, the charge sheet, the nature of the evidence at trial, the definition of unlawful force and how we sort of conceptualize that, all of those things give sufficient notice to the appellant at the time of trial that unlawful force will be presented in this manner. So we've gone from sort of a specific allegation of unlawful force to a more broad, but it was always incorporated in what would have had to, what the appellant had to defend against at trial.
Counsel,
he did.
You previously distinguished the United States against Riley. How would you distinguish United States against Dunn, the Supreme Court case?
Yes, Your Honor. So I believe that's also distinguishable in its facts, like Riley, that case was not a variance case, but also a change in theories case, where the government was moving from a theory of adoption of a prior statement not presented to a trier of fact to one where there was a false statement at a particular ancillary proceeding. So they had charged the wrong ancillary proceeding or a proceeding that was not ancillary. That was an essential element of that charge, but it is distinguishable from this case where we're still talking about unlawful force. And even accepting out that language, what remains is a whole specification that does not fail to state an offense, that states an offense and gives the appellant proper notice.
I ask a follow-up question, which is that it seems that both sides agree that the CCA cannot affirm on the basis of a different theory of liability. What is your definition of what a different theory of liability is? I mean, my understanding from the appellant was that if you, even if it's unlawful force, if you specify the specific facts through a two-wit clause or with a bill of particulars, that is your theory. How would you define what this, I mean, everybody agrees the rule is you can't affirm on a different theory, but what is a different theory?
I believe, Your Honor, it's that conversation we had earlier about moving between Article 120 Alpha 1 through 5, meaning moving from unlawful force to force likely to cause death or grievous bodily harm, threatening or placing in fear, drug or intoxicant, rendering unconscious. Those are theories of criminal liability that the government charges in its specification. What we're talking about and what's happening in this case is we're moving through the different underlying facts to establish that same essential element, unlawful force.
How would we articulate that if we were to state a rule?
Your Honor, admittedly, it's a difficult undertaking in the sense that it is based on the charged offense, the nature of what needs to be charged in any specification for that charged offense. So it's difficult to say that there is one rule that would apply to every situation. But what the difference ultimately is what we're talking about is underlying facts as opposed to an overarching theory of criminal liability.
Major Ohinga, can I get back to Judge Olson's issue about a bill of particulars? Now, as I recall, a bill of particulars cannot be used or requested by the defense to restrict the government's case. So one of the questions I suppose, and this is more rhetorical than anything else, but had the defense at the trial requested a bill of particulars to make more definite how this force, unlawful force, was applied, would the judge have granted them that, a bill of particulars? That's one question. And then let's assume that maybe the judge would not have, because the argument would have been that the bill of particulars is, in this case, being designed to restrict the government's proof. Now, it seems in this case, the government has conceded to the defense something they would not have gotten in a bill of particulars. And having done so, aren't you now burdened with what you would have had to do if a bill of particulars had been granted? In other words, since the bill of particulars, there's no bill of particulars in this case, let's assume he wouldn't have been able to get one. Now that the government has decided to make more definite the lawful and unlawful force, aren't they bound by that as if they would be with the bill of particulars is the basic question. Unless you believe that the government is not bound once a bill of particulars is issued.
So, no, Your Honor, I don't believe that the government is bound by a bill of particulars.
You don't?
Perhaps the conversation would be about whether or not the government inappropriately misled the accused as to what he had to defend against, right? But we would be having the broader conversation about what he is actually placed on notice for.
No, let me go back on what you just said. You said that the government would not be bound by a bill of particulars, right? Is that your position? When the judge issues a bill of particulars, grants a bill of particulars to the defense, isn't the government bound by that? And I'm not saying that would have been the case here, but I think you're suggesting that generally, when a bill of particulars is granted, that the government is not bound, well, then what would be the purpose for granting the bill of particulars? I know this issue doesn't come up a lot, so I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I'm trying to understand what is the difference, getting back to Judge Olson's comment, what is the difference between being bound, let's assume for the sake of argument that the government is bound by the bill of particulars if issued. What is the difference between that and the situation we have here where the government has actually done what a bill of particulars might do? Isn't the whole idea from a bill of particulars is to avoid the defense from being surprised as to what they have to defend against?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess in terms of not being bound, the government does not change the nature of what is charged and the evidence that needs to be presented. That's what
okay.
Bill of particulars does not do that.
Okay.
Yes, the government is bound to its representations mm-hmm. To the accused, to the appellant,
mm-hmm.
But ultimately, in determining whether or not the specification should be affirmed, whether or not it was beyond a reasonable doubt, and whether or not the appellant was placed on notice of what he had to defend against.
Mm-hmm.
The bill of particulars doesn't sort of constrain that conversation where we're only talking about what was contained in the But here, appellants did have notice based on the nature of the charge sheet, based on the nature of the charge itself, and based on our conception or in our understanding of proving unlawful force beyond a reasonable doubt.
All right.
Do you disagree that the charge that the CCA approved is broader than the charge that was drafted?
I think the underlying facts are broader, but the accused was, or the appellant was always charged with unlawful force. All of the facts that were considered, all of the facts that were entered into evidence about duct taping and the brutal beating beforehand, all of those things would have been considered. So yes, we've gone from specific to more general, but it is the same unlawful force that always had to be defended against, Your Honor.
Can I beat my dead horse one more time here? In the case of a bill of particulars, you're dealing with the offense that's charged. In other words, say we would have had the less broad specification alleged here without the two wit. Then the defense would have asked for a bill of particulars, and maybe the judge will have granted it to specify how the unlawful force was granted. That's a little bit different, don't you think? Because originally that's what the government is trying to do, simply have a broad allegation of unlawful force. But what they did in this case was narrow it on their own to this specific modality or manner of unlawful force. So doesn't that kind of mislead the defense into thinking that they should devote their efforts and resources into defending against this particular manner of unlawful force, only to find out that, oh, we wasted our time because the government still wins on the broader theory, or for lack of a better word, of the offense. My question is, does that mislead them? And I guess your colleague can maybe address that when she comes back. That's my question.
Yes, Your Honor. I see that my time has expired. May I respond?
Please answer the question.
So, Your Honor, even if that were an issue, I think the underlying problem is notice here. And what we have is a charge sheet replete with unlawful force. We have duct taping. We have a brutal beating, pushing her head into the ground. We have.
So you're saying you have to take in the context of how this offense arose.
Yes, Your Honor. So we would be having a conversation about whether or not it was misleading, but we cannot be limited to only the context of the hypothetical bill of particulars. We would be looking at the nature of the charge sheet. We'd be looking at the nature of the evidence as it came out in the Article 32. We'd be looking at the evidence as it came out at trial. All of those things put together say that appellant was on notice of also a general theory of unlawful force.
All right. Thank you. Chief Judge, thank you for allowing me the extra.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Judge Sparks, to address your question,
understanding.
Which one? Well, the most recent one, Your Honor. Sure. Understanding what my friend across the aisle is saying about the nature of the evidence, the problem is the government controls the charge sheet this entire time. The CG referred this specific charge sheet to trial. They've articulated the manner or method by which the crime was going to be committed, and they have to live with that. And that is a very big difference. And I think that to answer your earlier question about, you know, what does shoving mean, Your Honor, and I believe that this will also, Judge Maddox, answer your question as well, specifically Reese. And I know I've come back to that a few times, but in Reese there was a difference between the word lick and the word which there might, maybe that makes it distinguishable from left and right because we still have the arm, but the method is still generally the same. But when the method changed from the words lick to grab, I mean, that's what makes a difference in this case. This case is very much like Reese, only happened at the appellate level.
And to say that it is a broader offense for which they have affirmed in this case, but it's a different offense because the method has changed. And when they decide to narrow that method, they have to live with that. And then the Army Court as well has to decide whether or not to affirm on that method. And that's what makes it, Judge Stuckey, a difference between the material element in this case, is because that was the actual manner by which the government chose that this crime was committed. And even if they had specified this in a bill of particulars, the government, if they have different facts, going back to how this whole conversation started, they can start narrowing that by arguing things in the conjunctive as well. But they made that decision when they controlled the charge sheet on how this was going to proceed, and the appellate court was limited to that. And with regards to a showing of prejudice, Dunn does not require a showing of prejudice in this case because the Army Court just does not have the authority to do this. Under Ober or Bennett or Riley 1, Dunn and Chiarella, all of those cases are pretty clear about what the theory of liability means. And here it's just a specific method by which they had charged. And therefore, it's for those reasons that appellant requests this court to dismiss the specification and remand to the CCA for a sentence reassessment. Because there is no lesser included offense, the next logical step is a dismissal, because they found that language, the method by which they believe the crime was committed, factually insufficient, Your Honor. Pending any further questions.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court thanks Counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:25.